welcome back to another episode of A Walk Back to Self-Love. I am always on the search for aligning and energy exchanging with incredible humans out in society doing good soul work. And I recently met Deek DeCaro, who is the executive director of the Winooski Housing Authority in Vermont. And there is, I believe, a hidden crisis tucked away in the Green Mountain State, and that is housing. So enjoy this episode. Hopefully you learn some new information and we keep that conversation going about the housing crisis. Hello, Deek.
Hello, Amber. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well.
Thank you so much for joining me on today's episode. I think Deek is amazing. We recently met, and Deek DeCaro is the executive director of the Winooski Housing Authority in Vermont. And Winooski is a suburb of Burlington. I think a lot of the shine happens around Burlington, but not necessarily or the familiarity of Winooski. So I wanted to invite Deek on today so we could talk about something that, of course, affects so many different humans across this country, but I don't think there's a lot of awareness around what's happening in the Green Mountain State of Vermont, and that is the housing crisis. So Deek, thank you for being here today. Before we get started, I love to hear the journey of someone. So how did you get into housing?
Well, good morning, Amber, and thanks very much for having me with you. This is exciting. I was born and raised in Winooski and have lived here all my life. So I guess fundamentally I've been looking for ways to serve the community, and I try really hard to do that. I was city manager here in the city of Winooski for 7 years, back starting in 2008. And, I started in Winooski during the financial crisis. And when that got over, I looked for opportunities to come back, and the housing authority was open, and housing is so fundamental, and it's the end of my career, so I just couldn't think of a better place to leave it all on the field but to work on housing in Winooski. And so here I am.
I think that's a wonderful transition, because you have the foundation of what you dealt with as a city manager. And I know when we met, you talked about having the experience with the police department and the operation of the city. And now, you know, you've switched hats and you've been dealing with the housing crisis. And so let's just dive right into that. What has happened in the Winooski Burlington area that has caused this massive example of displaced humans right here in Vermont?
You know, that's a good question. And like all systems, I don't think you can grab like one thing and say, oh, it's this. You know, I think there's part of it is we haven't kept up on housing infrastructure, affordable or otherwise. And just like any other piece of infrastructure, we just haven't kept up for 20 years. So we have had an increasing shortage of housing for the better part of a decade, if not more. And wow. Any time you have a shortage of anything, supply and demand will tell you that prices go up. So you know, those two things are happening. Housing has been going down, and prices have been going up, which is pricing a lot of just working class folks out of the market. And this didn't happen quickly. It just, like all problems, they happen really slow until they happen. They suddenly fall off a cliff. And I think the pandemic was just what put something that was happening slowly anyway, it pushed it off the cliff. I think the other interesting thing that's going on here is the building that we're doing is one bedroom. And oftentimes to make room for 41 bedroom units, we're tearing down two units with four bedrooms apiece. So even though we may be housing more people, we're displacing families a little bit here and there, and especially in the affordable market. So, that's a high level issue of what's going on. And then when you add substance abuse and mental health crisis on top of everything else, you know, it's a soup of problems.
Yeah, there's a lot there, Deek. There's a lot there. So we'll start with something that we talked about recently, and that's correct me if I'm wrong, most of the building is happening for studio and one bedroom. So do you think that low key there's a discrimination going on to multifamily units and situations?
I don't know if I would call it discrimination. There is a long waiting list for one bedroom housing. Okay. It moves quickly, but there's a lot of people on it. And I think that's just a function of baby boomers who are getting out of their family houses and moving it, wanting and needing one bedrooms. Plus, you know, a lot of young professionals, you know, have had it with the roommate thing in college and want their own bedroom. So there's no question there's a market there that's being met. The problem is that in order to meet that, you know, we're displacing some really old housing, but that old housing had 4 and 5 bedrooms in it. So the bigger families are getting displaced. I don't know as it's out and out discrimination, but you know, capital markets have that as a feature. I mean, So where
what are the options then for 3 to 5, you know, family houses to live if they want to stay in Vermont?
So right now, that's getting increasingly difficult. And the problem is we're going to have to build our way out of this this issue, and we're going to have to build our way quick. Because if you think about who lives in those apartments, a lot of times, especially rental apartments, a lot of times those are your housekeepers, your kitchen folks, you know, folks that are landing here and trying to get their feet on the ground. In a lot of cases, in our case, in Winooski, learn English. It's a big source of a group of the labor market here that's sorely missing. So we're going to have to build our way out of this, and we're going to have to build our way quickly, which [S2] Right. [S1] Means we need to figure out money, because of course we're trying to do that while interest rates and inflation is working against us as fast as we're trying to build.
Now, what about the local city government in Winooski? Are they open and understanding of the financial difficulties to meet this requirement?
Oh yeah. We meet with stakeholders. During the pandemic, we were meeting once a week. Now we're meeting once a month. But we're well talking to each other all the time about, you know, again, I'm sure from your experience, you know how zoning plays a role. I mean, there's all kinds of public policy that comes to play. And the city of Winooski is working really hard to try to figure that out, and from everything from parking requirements to density. But our zoning was never designed to get ourselves out of a housing crisis. It was designed to maintain, you know, the feeling of a suburb in Vermont. Mm-hmm. So when you start talking about how many units you can build on an acre, it favors single, you know, occupancy homes, single family homes, and not dense neighborhoods. Right. So the city is really working hard trying to figure that out. I got to hand it to them. They're trying.
Yeah, so it just really sounds like this couldn't have been projected, you know, long term, of what was going to unfold in Winooski or Burlington.
You know, everything. Let me say it this way: everything looks like we should have seen it coming in retrospect, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't matter what, you know. We say that to ourselves all the time, you know, and the way we say it is like hindsight is 20/20, right? Right. Hindsight is not 2020. If we had gone a different way, we would have had a different set of problems. So life doesn't bifurcate like that. But we didn't see it coming. Whether we should have or not, hard to argue.
Right. And then also what probably most people don't realize, and I didn't until almost a year ago, is that Winooski is celebrated and known as a refugee welcomed city and town for families, correct?
That's what we do. Yeah. And so my ancestors, so I grew up here, I've lived here all my life. My ancestors were French Canadian. The landing point of the new immigrants from French Canadian to Irish to Lebanese to Vietnamese have come through Winooski. That's what we do. And we've been good at it for over 100 years. So,
So fun little fact, Winooski is known as the Onion City. to make a lighter note of the conversation.
Yes.
Why is it known as the Onion City?
So Winooski's on the banks of the Winooski River, and there was wild onions that grew along the banks of the river. And as the Abnaki and native folks in the area didn't necessarily live here, but as they moved from their winter to their summer quarters, they would collect the wild onions. And so that's where that comes from. And, you know, the argument goes back and forth. Was it an onion? Was it a leek? But let's just say onion is better for a whole lot of good reasons.
Right. I always love learning fun little facts, especially about cities and, you know, where I'm living. So, like I stated, Winooski is a suburb of Burlington. And I read recently that Burlington was discussing the short-term rental compliance effort that's mm-hmm. underway. Mm-hmm. Is Winooski, and I know I've asked you this, you have plenty of conversations with the Burlington Housing Authority. So it's kind of like a low-key partnership, correct?
Yeah, we're all trying to solve the same problem. If we can't compete, we got to work together. So we do.
And so what does that, is there short-term rental compliance in Winooski or is that just in Burlington?
Right now, we're all looking at short-term rental and compliance. As a matter of fact, I think if you look nationally, that's a huge issue in all kinds of cities. And the question is, how do you get at that? Do you make it illegal? Do you tax it so it's not beneficial? You know, there's within our structure, how exactly or what is the best way to motivate folks to not go with a short-term rental? And I'm not sure. I keep reading up on that, and I'm not sure the answer is really clear. So I know we're studying it. I know they're looking at, you know, do you tax it so that the profit doesn't outweigh what you'd get in rent? Do you just make it illegal, which somebody is going to say, how dare you tell me what I can do with my property? It's not an easy and simple question that, oh, here's the language, put it in your zoning and you're done.
Right, because of course it is a battle, residents versus property management. And then I would say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the middle person is usually the housing authority or some sort of government agency to kind of step in and help both sides, correct?
Yeah, and in some cases we just, and this is what, you know, we're looking at is, and we've done it in the past, where do we just purchase assets to retain them, you know? If you know, keeping our eye out for just, you know, I don't want to control the universe. It's not my job to, like, own all the rentals. But you know, that is one structure that we can bring to the table to try to retain some of the bigger units. And so, you know, we're constantly looking for that. Winooski, for your listeners, is 1.4 square miles. It's fully built out, except for some natural areas that are protected, because you need to do that too. About 2/10, 2.5, maybe of that is underwater. So, you know, we're working with a little bit less than a square mile here. So, you know, it's fully built, and that presents its own challenges. On the other hand, we're really small, and we can try a lot of things that bigger communities aren't limber enough to try. And we recognize that. And so that's kind of when we're looking at these problems, like short-term rentals, you know, I know they're looking at how do we try a whole bunch of things and see what works.
Right.
And we all know each other. So we have a lot of trust where other communities may not have that trust.
Well, and I think that that's so important, because as a society, especially modern day current, we lack trust with each other. And that's one of the first foundational requirements with community and to move forward with any crisis is trust.
Absolutely. I mean, I, you know, watch how we can't get anywhere nationally. And even in very local areas, because we spend all our times assuming the worst of each other, and assuming that because somebody disagrees with me, they're wrong. And it's even worse now, because it's not they're wrong, they're evil.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because we're a smaller, intimate place here in Winooski, it's harder to make that judgment about people because you know them and you see them walking their babies and you see them, you know, you see these couples progress. It's cool. From, you know, walking the dog to then the dog and the baby and then the two kids. And you know, you, even if you don't know their names, you say hi. And you, so it's just cool because that's kind of the foundation of trust, right? Is just kind of seeing people as human beings and not as political positions or opinions.
But that's really hard to do, obviously.
Oh, man. And on a bigger scale, it's really hard. But Winooski, you know, is such a small scale that we literally do run into each other all over the place all the time.
Yeah, I even know that. I mean, I've been here next month. It'll be a year. And I mean, sometimes you're doing like 2-3 times you run into the same person. You're like, what are the chances? And then you're like, well, I forget where I'm living. It's not like a huge metropolitan city.
I would not describe this as a huge metropolitan city of about 7,200 people. No.
And Burlington either.
Right. Well, Burlington likes it. So Burlington functions more like that just because they are the biggest city in Vermont. And
yeah,
for those who've never been, Burlington gets more out of its size than almost any city I've ever been in.
Really?
Yeah. Because of the college, they have a huge art scene. You know, their art scene is just to die for. You know, there's a couple of good museums and it's just, you know, if you're spending a weekend, you can keep yourself well entertained. And so, yeah, it does. When I was in college, I actually was a security guard with the American Olympic boxing team. So sometimes I use those references. But so Burlington punches above its weight.
Very fitting. Yeah, because most people, and we talked about this when we met, most people connect Burlington or Vermont to either Bernie Sanders or Burton Snowboards or just, you know, friendly Vermonters. But unless you live here or happen to do your research, you don't know what's really on the underbelly of the surface of Vermont.
No, and it's easy to miss the pragmatic nature of what happens underneath what you see when you hear Bernie talk, right? If you're somewhere else and you hear Bernie talk, he's, you know, very philosophical, mm-hmm. you know. But it's hard to understand how you land that stuff in different communities. You know, like how do you make it work every day? And so we're a pragmatic people and for everybody's benefit, I do not own a pair of Birkenstocks and never have.
So you can crush that stereotype.
Yeah, well, at least for me, and I don't even drive a Subaru, but you know what?
so funny. But also another layer to the housing, what's going on here in Vermont, and you touched on it briefly, and we've discussed it. The drug problem here is outrageous and the mental health, just like most places in this country, but mm-hmm. because it's smaller, it's in your face more. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, it's everywhere. And I take public transportation in Burlington, so mm-hmm. I see it every day and it's mm-hmm. so sad. And are there any solutions that the state is trying to work together to have so we can fix this?
So you're into something that we deal with all the time because our mission is to house folks that are hard to house, and this is again reached crisis. Mental health care got disassembled in the 80s and under the Reagan policy of decentralizing services. And to be fair, I mean, you can argue the politics, but on a practical level, that care wasn't very pretty back then. And institutionalizing folks didn't look like Rain Man in a lot of cases, for those of you who are old enough to remember that movie. But nothing got put in its place. And so now we have a very disconnected mental health system. And often what we're finding anyway is substance abuse is, in a lot of cases, a self-medicating issue. I was reading an obit the other day of somebody who had died of what appeared to be a drug overdose, although it's hard to tell. But what the obit said is the person died of depression. And I just really appreciated that. So the link to untreated mental illness, and that, you know, because that's what we see more often than not is untreated mental illness and substance abuse,
right,
is huge. My wife is working on medication-assisted therapy, so I don't obviously know her clients, but I pick her brain about the problem. They're using a hub and spoke system. This gets to housing. So what they do is, as you're getting clean from your substance abuse problem, they move you into less and less restrictive care. And then if you have a relapse, you can go back to more and more restrictive care and then come out. I would like to argue that if we could do that with housing, so that when people could function independently, fine. When they get in crisis, we have a way of moving them into not more restrictive, but more supportive environments. And rather than fret about all the money, let people keep their subsidy. So you get a subsidy out of HUD. Wherever you go, your housing subsidy follows you. So even if you're in a supportive environment, they're only worried about paying for your care, not your housing. Mm-hmm. And so that's a model I'm trying to float. And because what you're seeing is all of that's tied to homelessness because people can't maintain their housing because they can't get treated for mental illness. So they're getting evicted because they're impossible to live around because they're, you know, we had, you know, we have situations all the time where, you know, they're either dealing drugs or they're violent or they're loud or whatever. We just need models that help people through all the different phases that they live through. Did that make any sense?
No, it does. And I think that it's one of the top priorities of what we lack as a society of compassion, empathy, and financial support is mental health. And I worked on a project in housing, as we discussed. Mm-hmm. And so I had a few of the residents dealing with mental health. And there were instances where I saw that person having to be evicted by what you just described, mm-hmm. and being in their unit. And also another layer to it is sanitary conditions.
Yes.
Because absolutely. Their mental health is so mm-hmm. terrible that mm-hmm. they can't wrap around the fact that, hey, how I'm living and how it's being presented to the outside is very unsanitary. And so then that's grounds for eviction if you don't maintain it. And if you aren't getting financial or resources for your mental health, then you're going to end up on the street and it almost lacking empathy. But unfortunately, it's a business.
Right. And we get caught in, who do we have empathy for? The person with the problem or the neighbors who are dealing with a cockroach problem that's moving in across the building, right? So, you know, we don't have any good choices either. And again, I think so much of this gets back to, by the way, Amber, I live in Winooski and I'm in the flight path. And if you're here, I'm right literally at the end of the runway. So if you hear planes, that's what's going on. And I just heard one. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
About who does it, you know, like whose side do you take? Neighbors, right. residents right. with mental health, or landlords.
That's right. And you know, so often when the sanitary conditions come into play, you might say, well, who cares how somebody lives? But you know, we have cockroaches fill up, you know, two or three apartments sometimes, not fill up, but start infesting neighbors. And then you got a whole other problem. So our failure here is to act, I think, as a system, right? So we are HUD. We are HUD funded. If you're moving to a mental health situation, then you have to move out of HUD and get yourself into Agency of Health, the Department of Health. Somehow and that's completely different. Your applications there's nothing. You have to start over from scratch as if you're not in the system. And then if you're moving back, you have to then go back to zero and start over again from the beginning, right? And you go on the back of the wait list and you go on the back of everything. And I watch this and it's like, can't these people be ours? And can't the system embrace humanity rather than and the fact that people are multidimensional and they need all this stuff rather than make people adjust to all of the different systems? Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, and also our society, the system that we live in, that we were born in, was not built for the complexities of mental health. Let's just be honest about that.
No, or that's, you're
the
right.
Compassion, or the compassion for it. So if right. the foundation was never built, how are you supposed to go to the system and ask for, hey, can we work together? Most of the time it's like, well, what's it going to cost?
And who's going to pay for it?
Exactly.
Yep.
Also, let's rewind a little bit. I want you to debunk this because I had asked so many people, especially working in housing here in Vermont, is it a myth? Because someone has told me, multiple people have told me, that cockroaches cannot survive in Vermont because of the cold. Is that true or false?
False.
Oh, okay, yeah. Thank you.
They can be treated. If we catch them early, they can be treated without a... So I made that sound like worse than it is. But if a unit gets it because they bring in food that has it, it can spread to a couple of units. But cockroaches are probably one of the most resilient creatures, right?
Yes. I used to live with them. It was hell.
Yeah, I mean, if you live in a big city, that's kind of it's kind of like the nature of the beast, right?
Right.
So we don't see it as much here. So when we do see it, it's like, oh my God. But it's more a function of the lack of density than it really is that cockroaches can't live here.
Okay, so that is, you know, it's a false narrative then, is what you're saying.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, great, because I thought, people are crazy. What are you talking about? But no, I mean, we talked about solutions and it seems like it's just a vicious cycle here. So what do people have to look forward to if there's at the current moment, like even the mayor of Burlington was quoted a few months ago saying he can't really project how many unhoused people are going to, you know, unfold this summer. So how do you find a solution and where do you see it moving forward?
Yeah, you're right. This is a problem that's virtually impossible to measure. They do an annual homeless count and try to get a handle on it, which I don't think has been done in a bit because of the housing provided through the pandemic. But you know, it's really hard. A lot of these folks don't have regular ID or you know, it's not like you can track a unique identifier or a name or anything. So it's a really hard problem to measure, and any problem that's hard to measure is hard to solve.
Right.
So, and that's for a number of reasons, including the fact that you can't get funding until you can measure something. So, you know, so that's also kind of a part of the problem. You know, so like I was telling you, I think places like Winooski are should be on the cutting edge of that. I think small places where we can try things and fail and learn and try something else, because one of the things in our society is we don't allow failure, which means we don't allow learning. Where did I hear this the other day that the biggest obstruction to learning is thinking that you know it already? That's a bad quote, but I wrote that quote down because I loved it. We need to fail. We need to try some things. We need to have things go wrong and to fix parts of it. And to, you know, we need to learn. We can't give advanced trigonometry in third grade. We got to figure out how to add first and to multiply and divide, you know, and somehow we're not going to solve a problem that's been really growing out of control, in particular since the 80s, but now is like in our face because of the housing crisis, in 5 minutes with a solution that we all come up with and just, you know, pass through Congress and it works because Congress isn't working. So what we need to do is find funding in places like Burlington and Winooski or small intimate communities. You can go up to 100,000, you know, people, in my opinion, but.
Hello?
Yeah, are you there? Did I lose you?
Are you there?
I am.
Okay, it cut out. Okay. Now we're back.
Sorry. You know, take small places and let us do demonstration stuff and let us learn and not hammer us for failing, but let us build relationships and figure this out. Because I think the answer, I don't have the answer. I'm a process person though by nature. And I'm thinking, let's start trying some things. And, you know, I'm saying breaking rules, but I don't really mean that. I mean, just take off some of the handcuffs of years and years and years of regulation and that don't allow us to be creative and give us some running room, because we don't, you know, in a lot of ways, regulation, I'm not necessarily an anti-regulation person, but in a lot of ways, it's like tying your shoes together and trying to run.
Right. And also accountability and talking about the truth of life, that also plays a factor into it as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think all of it is a concoction of, okay, now we can move forward with plans, solutions, and see how we can fix it. And then also, and tell me how you think about this with the busing system here. I think it's been wonderful that it's been free fare since I've lived here almost a year and there's an extension on it. But also, who all day, for the most part, has access to free bus is people who are unhoused, people who suffer with mental health. If you add back in fare, do you think that will change the landscape of the public transportation and what happens with unhoused and mental health residents?
Okay, I'm going to go back to another job and give you a little history. When I was I like to call myself the evil parking director at the University of Vermont, and I call myself that because people swore I lived off their parking tickets. We gave free bus fare to everybody in the university. All they had to do was swipe. Are you there?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I'm here.
All they had to do was swipe. So the entire university community could ride the bus free. And it completely changed who was on the bus. Not that the homeless people, not that those people were moved off, because they weren't. But the mix of people on the bus was very different. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, so I have a little experience with free, but from a completely different perspective. You know, it worked well. I don't know what's happening now. We had a huge uptake. I don't know what it's going to take to redo that. But the communal mix didn't make it look like it was you riding the bus with one person with mental health and a driver.
Right.
You know, that's not what the bus felt like. And so we increased the people using public transit, which was incredibly important for our climate goals at the time, still is. And yet for some reason that seems to have dropped off, and I don't know what that's about. And so that's got me scratching my head, Amber. I was at a time up to my elbows in transportation policy, but I haven't touched it in a while.
Yeah, and of course, you know what the dialogue is that follows that is taxes, money, who's going to pay for it? Because that's always the conversation when you're talking about either a crisis or some sort of theory and factor in society. It's always, well, who's going to pay for that?
Right.
So, and I think that's what the conversation is right now for this area is, well, who's going to pay for it if it's free?
And you know, that's the problem, right? Because, I mean, look at the healthcare debate. Mm-hmm. Even if the government ran an incredibly expensive single payer, you know, the government ran healthcare, it would be so much cheaper because you're not paying for the 11% overhead that goes to the insurance companies and so forth and so on, right? So a solution where we're paying something through taxes is not necessarily more expensive than what we're paying now. If I don't need a second car, then the taxes I'm paying to support transportation is minuscule compared to what it costs me to make a car payment, pay to have the car insured and to run it, right? I mean, it's right. Minuscule. And yet, you know, somehow we, we just miss that. And, you know, in Europe, this is a no-brainer. I mean, you wouldn't, I mean, especially in the bigger cities in Europe, you wouldn't even think about trying to drive your car somewhere. Much less even between areas, you know, it's because the transportation system works. But it's not necessarily more expensive if you don't need to pay for a second car. So that's the challenge is how do we see, again, it's back to the system, right? It's back to, I don't want to pay taxes. So instead of paying $30 more in taxes, I'm willing to pay $3,000 more a year to get my car.
Yeah.
It's where we are.
And I think people are just hardwired to believe that the only way of transportation is through a car. I used to be one of them. I used to pray. I tell you, I used to pray to not have a car. Now that I don't have a car, there are times that I, of course, get in my head like, oh, it would be nice just to get in the car. But I will say the Burlington area is fantastic with the public transportation. It takes you everywhere to the suburbs of Burlington, all the way out to the capital, Montpelier. Like, it goes everywhere that I really am not lacking in my life right now by not having a vehicle. And plus, there's the car share Vermont. Yep. You could Uber, you could rent a car if you want to. But also, I mean, obviously that takes finances and things. And if people don't have that because they're pouring it into housing, well, you know, and that's where I think the debate of the free public transportation is still kind of in conversations. So I just wanted to pick your brain on that. But I really, I think that you are very insightful, very passionate. You obviously are dedicated to finding a solution, but like we all know, solutions are not immediate. And we are such a instant gratification society that we want. I mean, even myself working for government agencies, the government moves on their own time, or like you said, do they move at all?
Right. It's not perceptible sometimes. I'll give you that. Can I leave you a little piece of data?
Yeah, of course.
Congressional Budget Office, CBO, in January of 2020 makes projections for the year. So before the before COVID, they projected where things would be in 2023, and they have to do that in order to figure out what things cost. Anyway, two pieces of data that make no sense that came out of that. The total population that they projected for 2023 in 3 years ago is slightly smaller, but there's 2 million more occupied units of housing than they projected. So while they projected a smaller population, the population is smaller, the housing occupation is bigger. There's something tied. I just saw that yesterday. I don't know what it is, but man, there's something to those numbers that we need to track.
Yeah, that doesn't, it's imbalanced.
Hugely. And so I know data, if we can measure it, we can fix it, but there's something very, very strange going on. So
just add it to the list.
Yeah. I don't have the answers, but not only do we want immediate success, we want it perfect for the first time. And we're not going to make any progress with either one of those two as expectations.
No, whether it's personally, professionally, or on a society level, perfection doesn't exist. And if you're striving for perfection, you actually sometimes miss the goal.
That's right. And that's why we isolate ourselves in privilege sometimes, because it can feel really perfect if you're isolated in your own sense of privilege, right? You can insulate yourself from the messiness of the world. That's kind of part of what functions around privilege.
Yeah.
And so when we have parts of our decision-making society that is kind of embedded that way, it gets even harder, because there is that expectation of just work hard.
Get a job.
Jesus. Yeah, I mean, you know, I have lots of folks saying, where did all the people go? It's like, well, we haven't had immigration for basically 5 years. Where do you think the people went?
Right. And then, even Vermont specifically, if no matter what age you are, and if you are able to, if you can't find housing or afford your day to day, you're going to look for options outside of the state of Vermont.
Yeah. And it's, you know, the housing that's affordable is not on the bus line. So while we have really good bus lines, I don't know if you know this, but each community can join or not, depending on whether they want to. So it's a little disjointed because of communities that haven't bought in. It's more than a little, so it depends on where you go, but you can find those gaps. So if you can't find housing on a bus line, and you can't afford to have everybody have a car that you know is going to start every morning, and, well, cockroaches can live in this weather. It gets cold here in the winter. Mm-hmm. And cars don't start. And there's road salt that tears apart a car a lot faster than it does in the South. You're dependent on a transportation system, and if it doesn't go near affordable housing, you've got another whole problem. And I think I want to add another piece to this conversation, but it's all linked. And if we don't see it as linked, we can't solve it.
Which goes back to the isolation of privilege, because if you have a car, and let's say you live further out in the more rural parts of Vermont, or, you know, you build a home and you're not day to day going to downtown or neighboring suburbs like Winooski, unless there's a concert or you want to go have dinner on, you know, Church Street, but you're not understanding or wanting to see what the issue is, because usually you just want to sit there and judge it. You just want to say, well, look at the drug addicts, look at the homelessness. I mean, I have seen in the last couple weeks, people pushing mattresses on top of their carts. Just, I mean, hey, listen, if you're going to be unhoused, you got to take care of yourself and look out for yourself. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you better wheel a mattress somewhere. At least have comfort while you're sleeping on a street, because not all homelessness can have that. So it's really, it's been so eye-opening. And I've lived in bigger cities. I'm from Metro Detroit. So it's like, this isn't new. But when you're in a smaller area, like a smaller city and town, it's just more in your face, and it's just really unfortunate.
Yeah, I'm gonna tell you two quick things. One is a bunch of years ago, I was heading from the airport to Pontiac, Michigan, and I got thrown off the interstate into the middle central of Detroit by Tiger Stadium, and yep. At 10:30 at night by myself in a car. So not all of it in Detroit was hidden to me that night. I can tell you that was a moment. That's my experience in Detroit. And during the light of day, Detroit is lovely. I'm not saying that. Second thing is, I want to, you know, we do have people of wealth here living in Vermont, but one of the interesting things is those folks really are interested and do view folks in homelessness situations less as obstacles and I'm finding people genuinely concerned at all levels and really trying to help. And so I want to be really careful without saying that just because somebody has privilege and wealth or whatever, they don't care. One of the beautiful things here, back to that Bernie Sanders comment, is those folks do vote to help these folks, and they do pitch in, and they do sleep at night and walk the cots, walk and raise money. There's a lot of money raised out of this community to solve those problems. And I think that gets back to the intimacy of it's not only in our face, but we start knowing these folks. It's not only, you know, we see them every day, just like the person walking their dog.
Right.
I'm finding it's not a nameless, faceless population all the time. I'm not saying that we're good at it, and I'm not saying that we don't have privilege, and I'm not saying that going home to a comfortable home doesn't insulate ourselves from the ins and outs of that. But I don't see the level of just judgment as much here as I've heard elsewhere. And I don't know if it's just because I'm in this business and so I'm exposed to people who don't feel that way.
Right.
Give you that. I have my social circle too, and my level of privilege and my limited perspective like everybody else.
And of course, you will have people that are out there raising money, trying to make positive change, trying to come up with solutions. But I think, of course, like with a lot of things on the required level, which is the political level, mm-hmm. you'll get that resistance. So it's wonderful to know that you do surround yourself with like-minded people who are out there advocating and financially coming up with solutions as best as possible. Because that's really it. And like I always say to my close circle, and this is very philosophical, but it's like we're floating in the middle of space on this planet, mm-hmm. trying to make sense of life and trying to live it as best as we can and help where we can. but we're being charged to live on this planet. And it's like housing is a basic need that is now really treated like a luxury.
Yep. And you're right. And we're not going to fix it with bingos and walkathons.
Exactly. Thank you. Thank you. But I really appreciate you, Deke, for carving out some time. I know you're busy. And I always like to ask my guests when I have them on, what does, and especially in the work that you have done and you still currently do, what does self-love mean to you?
You know, I think most of us who do this work are going to struggle with that answer, right? Because we're climbing hills, and we sometimes focus on the hills and not on taking care of ourselves. So I've started really taking time thinking about meditation, and self-love to me right now is trying really hard to, within myself, maintain a sense of peace by maintaining a sense of perspective of who I am, and how I fit and how I, and what's mine to solve and what's not. But to do that, you know, within myself, I'm 60, or I'll be 65 shortly. And I can tell you that's a new insight for me, is I can no longer just run through walls. And it's not my job to run through walls. It's my job to be the best person I can figure out how to be, and to try to bring that to others. So my self-love is really learning to figure out how to keep my heart and my head in a good place, and be satisfied with what I can and can't do.
I love that. And it's very important. And I think that more people are trying to incorporate that in their day-to-day life, but it's hard.
I was joking. I was with somebody going through medical tests, and it was breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. And it's like, God, you guys should just bring in some Buddhist meditation when you do this, because, you know, you could do two things at once and it'd be cool.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much, Deke. I appreciate you, and keep doing the good soul work that you are doing for Winooski and the state of Vermont.
Well, thank you, Amber, and keep up the messaging, man. It's really important to bring as many people we can into the conversation. That's how we solve it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Deke.
Take care, Amber. Bye now.
Bye. I want to thank Deke DeCaro for joining me on this episode to talk about something so important like the housing market here in Vermont. And so hopefully you would learn some new information and continue to have those discussions in society and match it up with action. So if you are on a mission, if you have a message and you would love to share it on the podcast, you can contact me at awalkbacktoselflove@gmail.com. And until next time, be kind to yourself and be kind to others. Thank you.